Yesterday morning, I received news that Hindu arsonists burned one of the evangelical free churches in northeast India to the ground in reaction to the evangelism that is taking place in that part of the country. It was probably 3 weeks or more, maybe 4 weeks ago, that we learned that in the state of Gujarat, India, and that is on the other side of the country from where our missions team is going this Friday, there a missionary and his two sons were killed by a crowd who saw him as a threat to their Islamic religion. I think a question that is reasonably asked by most of the world is this: if that man who was killed was so unwelcomed in that country, why was he even there? Just recently, we saw pictures of the living conditions of Wayne and Amy Losey from our church and their daughters in another country in Central Asia. For several days, some time back, they had to leave their home and wait in another city because of the religious unrest in the area where they had been living. Amy is housebound for days at a time because of the customs in that country that make it virtually impossible for a woman to be able to go outside without certain conditions being met. It seems to me that reasonable people would ask, why are Wayne and Amy and their daughters in that country? Why would they choose to live there? Vaughn and Delene Newcomb are in another country in Central Asia where just recently even getting enough electricity and heat was a major concern for them and for their two preschool children. They are attempting to learn the language. They struggle with just the routine issues of daily living. Buying food and other activities are both time-consuming and very frustrating. Again, I think the question can be asked, why are they there? Why would anyone choose to live that way? Bill and Lori Bolthouse are in Macedonia, and they keep their and their children's bags packed, and they also have an evacuation plan all in order because of the ethnic fighting in nearby Kosovo and Albania. And that fighting threatens all the time to spill over into their area of the world. Why stay under those conditions? Now, I know that what I have done is paint a fairly bleak picture of the lives of our missionaries, and I want you to know that they also have some very excellent times. But nonetheless, I think the question can be asked, why are they there? Why would they choose to live that way? These are all very capable and, in most cases, very highly educated people. They had occupations or professions here in the States that were earning them very good incomes with bright prospects for the future. Why would they go to a disadvantaged and dangerous, even, backwater part of the world? I have seen and read some of their emails and letters during their first months in those places, and I have heard the pain that they experience in separation from family and friends. I know the discouragements that they face in just making it through each day, and I have also heard them express some of their doubts about the choices they have made. Why are they there? I've talked with the parents and grandparents of those young adults and their children. And again, I think the question is why. You spend your life trying to protect your children and prepare them for life. You grow to like them, not just love them. You thoroughly enjoy being with them, and you can hardly wait to watch your grandchildren grow up. Why on earth would those parents and grandparents not only willingly send their children, but encourage them to go? Why are family and friends willing to give significant portions of their income to support these missionary families? 99 families in this church last year gave over $5,000 each toward the ministries of Southern Gables, including our missions outreach. Many families give 10, 15, 20% of their income to support such ministries around the world. Many people pray not just for minutes, but for hours each month when they think about global evangelization. Why would people make such an investment of their time and their money? Let me show you why. According to the Bible, from the very beginning, when God first created the world and created humanity, it had been God's intention to bless this world. It was never God's intention to simply create men and women and then lose them as God would watch unmoved and unacting as they destroyed themselves. That was never his intention at all. His intention has been to bless this world. Now, as we've already seen in the first 11 chapters of this book, God refuses to give up on humanity. Adam and Eve were blessed beyond description. We call it the Garden of Eden. They were given the privilege of being the means whereby many other people would experience the same blessings of God that they had enjoyed. But they sinned against God, desiring to live their lives by their own rules instead of God's. And God expelled them from the garden. But God didn't give up. As I mentioned last week, he gave them a new beginning. For from their son Seth and other children they had, people began to spread out across the world, and they were enjoying the blessing of God. That's why God created them, to enjoy him and the blessings he would give them. But they sinned against God to the point that God finally said of people, every inclination of the thoughts of their hearts were only evil all the time, and so God judged them. The flood came, and God destroyed them all, except Noah and his family. And with Noah and his family, God gave humanity another beginning. But the blessing that God wanted to bestow on people in this world was rejected. They decided to build their own significance. They decided to build their own security. And so God again has to judge, as we saw last week from Genesis chapter 11. God confused their language and he scattered them over the face of the world. But God still was not done. God reached down into that sea of humanity, and he selected one man through whom God desires to continue to bless all of humanity. That one man is Abraham. And that brings us in the scriptures, in the book of Genesis, to Genesis chapter 12. I'd like for you please to stand at this time in honor of God's word as I read those first five verses of Genesis chapter 12. The Lord had said to Abram, "Leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go into the land that I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you." So Abram left, as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he set out from Haran. He took his wife Sarai, his nephew Lot, all the possessions they had accumulated, and the people they had acquired in Haran, and they set out for the land of Canaan, and they arrived there. You may be seated. Now, next week, we're going to look more closely at this man, Abram, and the very specifics of this text that I have just read. But this morning, I want you to see the context in which this statement by God is made to Abram, otherwise known as Abraham. When we come to the 12th chapter of the book of Genesis, there's a very definite shift in the focus of the book. At chapter 12, there's a shift that takes place. Prior to this, that is in chapters 1 through 11, the whole of humanity is being written about. Starting back at the Garden of Eden with the command given to Adam and Eve, we see the growth of the human race from Adam and Eve clear down to the time of the flood. All humanity is in focus. Then again, after the flood, we see when we read those chapters, early chapters in Genesis, that the focus is on all of humanity up to the time of the scattering of the peoples across the face of the earth at the Tower of Babel. But in chapter 12 and following, we see that the focus of the book turns to one family. And from that one family, an entire group of people. They are the descendants of Abraham's grandson, Jacob, who otherwise is known to us as Israel. So at chapter 12, there's a switch from a focus on the entire world to a focus on one family and their descendants. Now, a casual look at the Old Testament would seem to indicate that God has turned his attention away from the world to just one people, as if the bulk of the Old Testament was written by the Jews, about the Jews, and for the Jews. And in fact, when you read the rest of the Old Testament, it becomes clear that it is mainly by Jews and mainly about Jews. but it is most definitely not only for the Jews. Something very significant happens here in this section of Genesis, specifically Genesis 10, 11, and 12. For in Genesis 10, 11, and 12, mainly in 10 and 12, and mainly in 12, verse 3, God sets the agenda for the rest of history. Something happens in this passage where it becomes very clear what God's agenda is and how God intends to fulfill his agenda. Listen to the verses again from Genesis chapter 12, this time just verses 2 and 3. Speaking to Abram, known as Abraham, I will make you into a great nation and I will bless you. By the way, the word nation there means a great people, meaning a great many people who will come from you and out of you. I will make you into a great nation and I will bless you and I will make your name great and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you and whoever curses you I will curse, and all the peoples and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. Now from the very beginning of creation, God's intention had been to bless the whole world. But what God is going to do is God is going to create for himself a people from all of the peoples of the earth. And what it says is, all the peoples will be blessed through you, Abraham. God's agenda has not changed. God's agenda today still includes people from every nook and cranny of the world. The shepherd people of Central Asia, the Kyrgyz people, the Albanians, the Navajos, the tribes of Southeast Asia. And we could go on to list people group after people group across the face of the earth. What I want to show you is how Moses, I want to show you how Moses, the author of Genesis, makes that so apparent, not only in this very powerful third verse of Genesis chapter 12, but how he makes it apparent even by the way he sets chapter 12 up. I refer specifically to chapter 10. That is, God's agenda is not only for a people. God's agenda is for all the peoples of the world. Now, the chronology of the events in chapters 9 through 12 of Genesis is different than the order of the chapters. You've probably noticed that in your own reading. Chapter 9 ends the flood with God's promise of a blessing on humanity if people will obey God and increase and fill the earth. Chapter 10 demonstrates how the descendants of Noah spread out over all of the earth. Chapter 11, however, in that chapter, Moses does what many authors do. He does kind of a flashback. He does a flashback to a time before chapter 10, after 9, but before 10, when he tells why it is that the people are spread out over all of the earth. Then we come to chapter 12. So if the chapters were written in chronological order, they would be 9, 11, 10, and 12. It's chapter 10 that sets the context for the significance of Genesis chapter 12, verse 3. Again, the question, who does God intend to bless through Abraham? It is all the peoples of the world. Look at the effort that Moses goes to in chapter 10 to demonstrate the various people groups of the world. He takes the time to mention the three sons of Noah and what people descended from those three sons. Now, I don't know about you, but as I have read Genesis many times, I find myself, at least I used to, find myself coming to chapter 10 and wondering why. Why would Moses spend all of this time giving us all of these names? Names that frankly mean very little to any of us and probably mean very little to most people down through the centuries since that day. Why would he give us the names? He takes the time to mention the three sons and who their descendants are, but in so doing, he does something very specific. Now, he mentions many of the descendants, first of all, of Japheth, one of the three sons of Noah. He indicates Japheth's sons and some of his grandsons, Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tyrus, seven in all. He mentions, however, only two of those sons when he starts to talk about their grandsons. So clearly he does not here indicate all of the descendants of Japheth. He gives us a sampling. Then he goes on to talk about Ham, the second son of Noah. Again, he mentions sons of Noah and grandsons. The sons are Cush and Mizraim and Put and Canaan. But again, we notice that he does not mention all of those sons more, and he only names some of the grandsons, though more than he did of Japheth. But they're not all listed. Why has he selected certain ones and not others to mention? Lastly, he writes of Shem. Again, I'm in chapter 10. And in speaking of Shem, we know that there's another reason for mentioning him, for it is from the line of Shem that finally Abraham comes. But in mentioning Shem and Shem's sons, though he mentions the sons, he only mentions a few of the grandsons, and then he only takes one of those grandsons to mention their heirs and descendants down to the time of Abram. Why certain sons, certain grandsons? And in fact, when we read these names, we quickly understand that Moses is not simply drawing up a family tree. For if he was doing that, this list would be far greater than what we see. He is describing, however, entire clans. He is describing entire families and people groups and nations that have descended from Noah. As I've already said, obviously, Moses does not mention every people group in the world. But what is very interesting is that he mentions 70. Picking certain names from Japheth and other names from Ham and other names from Shem, he comes up with a list that has 70 people groups of the world mentioned in his list. Other places in the Old Testament, as here, whenever that name 70 is used, it seems very clear that it indicates a completeness, a wholeness. It was never Moses' intention to mention all of them. He mentioned 70 to indicate to us that he is mentioning everyone. He's meaning by the 70 to be all-inclusive. It is all the families and people groups of the world. Just as significantly, the 70 that he does mention do not simply come from one relatively small area. He picks 70 very strategically because when you look at the 70 on a map, you find out that those 70 cover the entire known world of Moses' day. Again, what is he indicating? He is indicating that these people have spread out over the entire world. So that when we come to Genesis chapter 12, verse 3, who does God have in mind when God says, all the peoples of the earth will be blessed through you? He clearly has in mind every people group of the world. God's agenda, set right here in Genesis chapter 12, is that not just Israel, but through Abraham, that is through Israel, God would reach out to bless the entire world. And that was his intention from the very beginning of creation. Now, I want you to look with me at several passages this morning of Scripture that I believe drive this point home so very well. We're going to jump in time several hundred years into the future from the time that Abram lived and even Moses lived to the time of Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 49, verse 6. Isaiah writes these words, "It is too small a thing for you to be my servant. I will also make you a light for the Gentiles, that you may bring my salvation to the ends of the earth." Now this was written 1,000 years after Abraham, and yet God's agenda through Israel is still outlined very carefully, that you may bring my salvation to the ends of the earth. Now let's jump forward even another 1,000 years to the New Testament, Acts chapter 3, verse 25. Here the Apostle Peter is addressing a gathering of Jews, and he says this, "And you, Jews, you are the heirs of the prophets and of the covenant that God made with your fathers." Example, God said to Abraham, "Through your offspring all the peoples on earth will be blessed." What does Peter say? Peter is saying that promise that God made to Abram 2,000 years earlier is still in effect today. That promise that God made that through Abram's descendants God would bless all the peoples of the world is still operative today. It was not only to the Jews, however, all over the world that God made this promise and would reach. In Galatians 3:8, listen again to the Apostle Paul. He writes, "The Scripture foresaw that God would justify the Gentiles by faith and announce the gospel in advance to Abraham, all nations will be blessed through you. Whether it's in the day of Abram himself, or 1,000 years later in the time of Isaiah, or 1,000 years later at the time of the apostles, that agenda of God is still unchanged. It has always been his intention, as it is even yet today, to reach every people group of the world. Now, by the time the New Testament comes, we find that Jesus and the apostles are referring to the church as the true descendants, the spiritual descendants of Abraham. That is, prior to that, those who were physically descended from Abraham, the Jews, thought of themselves as the people of God, through whom God would bless the world if they understood God's promise and God's command. But by the time of the New Testament, it becomes very clear that the church is now perceived as the spiritual descendants of Abraham. And to the church has been given that same promise, that same command that had been given to Abraham 2,000 years earlier. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9, using language strikingly similar to the language that was used of Israel, a language that called Israel to be a light to the nations. Here's what Peter says is God's purpose for the church. But you, the church, you are a chosen people. You are a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people belonging to God. For what purpose? That you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Verse 12, live such godly lives among the pagans, the nations, that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. That is, the day when Jesus comes again. And because the whole world is God's agenda, Jesus said to his disciples in Acts 1:8, you will receive power when the Holy Spirit comes on you, and you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth. So in Matthew 28:19, Jesus said, therefore go and make disciples of all nations. Matthew 24:14, and this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations. And then the end will come. Something very significant happens in Acts chapter 2. When Peter and the other apostles take this commissioning of Jesus, this reiteration of the commission and the command of God that had been in existence for 2,000 years from the very day of Abraham in Genesis 12:3, when those apostles take that same commission seriously and they begin to preach, the very first sermon they preach is attended by people from where? Acts chapter 2. From all over the world, the known world. Listen to it in Acts 2. Now there were staying in Jerusalem God-fearing Jews from every nation under heaven, Parthians, Medes, Elamites, residents of Mesopotamia, Judea and Cappadocia, Pontus and Asia, Phrygia, Pamphylia, Egypt and the parts of Libya near Cyrene, visitors from Rome, Cretans and Arabs. When we compare the listing of the nations here with the one in Genesis chapter 10, 2,000 years earlier, we find striking similarities. What the apostle notes for us in Acts 2 is that the people in attendance at that sermon in Jerusalem in that day were people who were coming from the very same corners of the earth to which the descendants of Noah were scattered after Babel. And in fact, if you were to take a map and look at that map and juxtapose the names from Genesis 10, the names of in Acts chapter 2, you would again find striking similarities. God's agenda for the world over 4,000 years now has never changed. His intention is to reach all the peoples of the world. And jumping ahead even yet, maybe only a few years or maybe even thousands of years into the future, this is what we read in Revelation chapter 5. When Jesus comes again and his people stand before him, Jesus, you are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals because you were slain, and with your blood you purchased men for God from every tribe and language and people and nation. You have made them peoples from all corners of the world to be a kingdom and priests to serve our God, and they will reign on the earth. God is today still working the plan he established 4,000 years ago with that one man, Abram. The only question is, will we believe? Will we truly believe that God is still powerfully at work to accomplish that agenda? Even after all of these years, are we willing to believe that God is still in that business? God is working everything exactly according to His plan to reach every people group of the world. The agenda for the world is set in Genesis chapter 12, verse 3. God is still working it today. In 2000 BC, Abram believed God. His son and grandson believed God. In 1500 BC, Moses believed God, as did Joshua. They understood Genesis 12:3, what God was doing in the world, and they believed. In 1000 BC, David believed. After him, the other prophets who spoke of that mission that God had given to his people, they believed. When Jesus Christ came, Mary believed. Peter very clearly believed. In AD 400, Augustine believed. AD 1500, Calvin and Luther believed. AD 1700, Whitfield and Wesley believed. AD 1900, Spurgeon and Moody believed. AD 1999, the Haleys believe it. That's why they're in Spain. The Bolthouses believe it. That's why they're in Macedonia. Why do we go to Spain? Why Kyrgyzstan? Why do we send our best, these young adults, into those parts of the world where most of us and they would rather not live? Why do we send them out there? Why do we give our money? Why do we give our grandchildren to be in places where we will never see them as often as we would love to see them? Because we believe that what God started with Abraham, God is still doing today, and we desperately want to be a part of what God is doing. Because we believe what He started there, He will bring to completion. I don't want to miss it. And I know you don't either. Pray with me, please.